Side 12. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 264. It's more than the Scrotas. The Blight had its hand in Rider design, too, at least to some degree. I can't imagine the takeover of Greenstalks being so smooth otherwise.
Yes. A risk. A very small risk compared to...
Fom didn't move, but something in him seemed to draw away from her, denying the support she could offer. A small risk? We don't know. The stakes are so high, I'm walking a tightrope. If I don't use Blue Shell now, we'll be shot out of space by the Blighter fleet. If I let him do too much, if I trust him, then he or some part of him could betray us. All I have is the God Shatter and a bunch of memories that... That may be the biggest fakes of all. These last words were nearly inaudible. He looked up at her, a look that was both cold and terribly lost. But I'm going to use what I have, Rav, and whatever it is I am. Somehow I'm going to get us to Tyne's world. Somehow I'm going to get Old One's God Shatter to whatever is there. It was another 3 weeks before Blue Shell's predictions came true. The OOB had seemed a sturdy beast up in the middle beyond. Even its damaged ultra drive had failed gracefully. Now the ship was leaking bugs in all directions. Much of it had nothing to do with FOM's meddling. Without those final consistency checks, none of OOB's bottom automation was really trustworthy. But its failures were compounded by FOM's desperate security fixes. The ship's library had source code for generic bottom automation. FOM spent several days revising it for the OOB. All four of them were on the command deck during the installation, Blue Shell trying to help, FOM suspiciously examining every suggestion. 30 minutes into the installation, there were muffled banging noises down the main corridor. Ravna might have ignored them, except that she'd never heard the like aboard the OOB. FOM and the riders reacted with near panic. Spacers don't like unexplained bumps in the night. Blue Shell raced to the hatch, floated Franz first through the hole.
I see nothing, Sir FOM.
FOM was paging quickly through the diagnostic displays, mixed format things partly from the new setup.
I've got some warning lights here, but...
Greenstalk started to say something, but Blue Shell was back and talking fast.
I don't believe it. Anything like this should make pictures, a detailed report. Something is terribly wrong.
FOM stared at him a second, then returned to his diagnostics. 5 seconds passed.
You're right. Status is just looping through stale reports.
He began grabbing views from cameras all over the OOB's interior. Barely half of them reported, but what they showed... The ship's water reservoir was a foggy, icy cavern. That was the banging sound. Tons of water, spaced. A dozen other support services had gone bizarre, and... The armed checkpoint outside the workshop had slagged down. The beamers were firing continuously on low power. And for all the destruction, the diagnostics still showed green or amber or no report. FOM got a camera in the workshop itself. The place was on fire. FOM jumped up from his saddle and bounced off the ceiling. For an instant, she thought he might go racing off the bridge. Then he tied himself down and grimly began trying to put out the fire. For the next few minutes, the bridge was almost quiet. Just FOM quietly swearing as none of the obvious things worked.
Interlocking failures, he mumbled the phrase a couple of times. The fire snuff automation is down. I can't dump atmosphere from the shop. My beamers have melted everything shut.
Ship fire. Ravna had seen pictures of such disasters, but they had always seemed an improbable thing. In the midst of universal vacuum, how could a fire survive? And in zero-G, surely a fire would choke itself even if the crew couldn't dump atmosphere. The workshop camera had a hazy view on the real thing.
true, the flames ate the oxygen around them. There were sheets of construction foam that were only lightly scorched, protected for the moment by dead air. But the fire spread out, moving steadily into still fresh air. In places, heat-driven turbulence enriched the mix, and previously burned areas blazed up.
"It's still got ventilation, Sir Fahm."
"I know. I can't shut it. The vents must be melted open."
"It's as likely software."
Blueshell was silent for a second.
"Try this."
The directions were meaningless to Ravna, some low-level workaround. But Fahm nodded, and his fingers danced across the console. In the workshop, the surface-hugging flames crept farther across the construction foam. Now they licked at the innards of the armor Fahm had spent so much time on. This latest revision was only half-finished. Ravna remembered he was working on reactive armor now. There would be oxidizers there.
"Fahm, is the armor sealed?"
The fire was 60 meters aft and behind a dozen bulkheads. The explosion came as a distant thump, almost innocent. But in the camera view, the armor dismembered itself and the fire blazed triumphant. Seconds later, Fahm got Blueshell's suggestion working and the workshop's vents closed. The fire and the wrecked armor continued for another half hour, but did not spread beyond the shop. It took 2 days to clean up, to estimate the damage, and to have some confidence that no new disaster was on the way. Most of the workshop was destroyed. They would have no armor on Tyne's world. Fahm salvaged one of the beamers that had been guarding the entrance to the shop. Disaster was scattered all across the ship, the classic random ruin of interlocking failures. They had lost 50% of their water. The ship's landing boat had lost its higher automation. OOB's rocket drive was massively degraded. That was unimportant here in interstellar space, but their final velocity matching would be done at only 0.4 Gs. Thank goodness the aggrav worked. They would have no trouble maneuvering in steep gravitational wells, that is, landing on Tyne's world. Ravna knew how close they were to losing the ship, but she watched Fahm with even greater dread. She was so afraid that he would take this as final evidence of Ryder treachery, that this would drive him over the edge. Strangely, almost the opposite happened. His pain and devastation were obvious, but he didn't lash out, just doggedly went about gathering up the pieces. He was talking to Blueshell more now, not letting him modify the automation, but cautiously accepting more of his advice. Together, they restored the ship to something like its pre-fire state. She asked Fahm about it.
"No change of heart," he finally said. "I had to balance the risks, and I messed up. And maybe there is no balance. Maybe the Blight will win."
The God-Shatter had bet too much on Fahm's doing it all himself. Now it was turning down the paranoia a little. 7 weeks out from harmonious repose, less than 1 week from whatever waited at Tyne's world, Fahm went into a multi-day fugue. Before, he had been busy, a futile attempt to run handmade checks on all the automation they might need at Tyne's world. Now, Ravna couldn't even get him to eat. The nav display showed the three fleets as identified by the news and Fahm's intuition, the Blight's agents, the Alliance for the Defense, and what was left of Chandra K. Commercial Security. Deadly monsters and the remains of a victim. The Alliance still proclaimed itself with regular bulletins on the news. SJK Commercial Security had posted a few terse refutations, but was mostly silent. They were unused to propaganda, or, as likely, uninterested in it. A private revenge was all that remained to Commercial Security. And the Blighter fleet? The news hadn't heard anything from them. Piecing together departures and lost ships, WarTracker's news group concluded they were a wildly ad hoc assembly, whatever the Blight had controlled down here at the time of the Rip debacle. Ravna knew that the WarTracker's analysis was wrong about one thing. The Blighter fleet was not silent. 30 times over the last weeks they had sent messages at the OOB in Scrota maintenance format. FOM had had the ship reject the messages unread and then worried about whether the order was really followed. After all, the OOB was of Rider design. But now the torment in him was submerged. FOM sat for hours staring at the display. Soon Chandra K would close with the Alliance fleet. At least one set of villains would pay. But the Blighter fleet and at least part of the Alliance would survive. Maybe this fugue was just God-Shatter getting desperate.
3 days passed. FOM snapped out of it. Except for the new thinness in his face, he seemed more normal than he had in weeks. He asked Ravna to bring the riders up to the bridge. FOM waved at the ultra-drive traces that floated in the window. The three fleets were spread through a rough cylinder, 5 light-years deep and 3 across. The display captured only the heart of that volume where the fastest of the pursuers had clustered. The current position of each ship was a fleck of light trailing an unending stream of fainter lights, the ultra-drive trace left by that vehicle's drive. I've used red, blue, and green to mark my best guess as to the fleet affiliation of each trace. The fastest ships were collected in a blob so dense that it looked white at this scale, but with colored streamers diverging behind. There were other tags, annotations he had set, but which he admitted once to Ravna he didn't understand. The front edge of that mob, the fastest of the fast, is still gaining. Blueshell said hesitantly, We might get a little more speed if you would grant me direct control. Not much, but... FOM's response was civil, at least. No, I'm thinking of something else, something Ravna suggested a while back. It's always been a possibility, and... I think the time may have come for it. Ravna moved closer to the display, stared at the green traces. Their distribution was in near agreement with what the news claimed to be the remnants of Chandra K commercial security. All that's left of my people. They've been trying to engage with the Alliance for 100 hours now. FOM's glance touched hers. Yeah, he said softly. Poor bastards. They're literally the fleet from Port Despair. If I were them, I'd... His expression smoothed over again. Any idea how well-armed they are? That was surely a rhetorical question, but it put the topic on the table. Wartrackers thinks that Chandra K had been expecting something unpleasant ever since the Alliance started talking death to vermin. Commercial security was providing deep space defense. Their fleet is converted freighters, armed with locally designed weapons. Wartrackers claims they weren't really a match for what the other side could field if the Alliance was willing to take some heavy casualties. Trouble is, Chandra K never expected the Planet Smasher attack. So when the Alliance fleet showed up, ours moved out to meet it. And meantime, the K.E. bombs were coming straight into the heart of Chandra K. Into my heart. Yes. The Alliance must have been running those bombs for weeks. FOM knew and laughed shortly. If I were shipping with the Alliance fleet, I'd be a bit nervous now. They're down in numbers, and those retread freighters seem about as fast as anything here. I'll bet every pilot out of Chandra K is dead set on revenge. The emotion faded. There's no way they could kill all the Alliance ships or all the Blights, much less all of both. It would be pointless to. His gaze abruptly focused on her. So if we leave things as they are, the Chandra K fleet will eventually match position with the Alliance and try to blow them out of existence. Ravna just nodded. In 12 hours or so, they say.
And then all that will be left is the Blight's own fleet on our tail.
But if we could talk your people into fighting the right enemies... It was Ravna's nightmare scheme. All that was left of Chandra K dying to save the OOB, trying to save them. There was little chance the Chandra K fleet could destroy all Blighter ships. But they are here to fight.
Why not a vengeance that means something? That was the nightmare's message. Now somehow it fit the God-shatter's plans. There are problems. They don't know what we're doing or the purpose of the Third Fleet. Anything we shout back to them will be overheard. Ultra Wave was directional, but most of their pursuers were closely mingled. Fahm nodded.
Somehow we have to talk to them, and them alone. Somehow we have to persuade them to fight.
Faint smile.
And I think we may have just the equipment to do all that. Blue Shell, remember that night on the high docks? You told us about your rotted cargo from Chandra K.
Indeed, Sir Fahm. We carried one-third of a cipher generated by SJK Commercial Security for the Razor Jaws. It's still in the ship's safe, though worthless without the other two-thirds.
Gram for gram, crypto materials were about the most valuable thing shipped between the stars, and once compromised, about the most valueless. Somewhere in out-of-bands cargo files, there was an SJK one-time communications pad, part of a pad.
Worthless? Maybe not. Even one-third would provide us with secure communications.
Blue Shell dithered.
I must not mislead you. No competent customer would accept such. Certainly it provides secure communication, but the other side has no verification that you are who you claim.
Fahm's glance slid sideways toward Ravna. There was that smile again.
If they'll listen, I think we can convince them. The hard part is, I only want one of them to hear us.
Fahm explained what he had in mind. The riders rustled faintly behind his words. After all their time together, Ravna could almost get some sense of their talk, or maybe she just understood their personalities. As usual, Blue Shell was worrying about how impossible the idea was, and Greenstalk was urging him to listen. But when Fahm finished, the large rider did not launch into objections.
Across 70 light-years, ultra-wave comm between ships is practical. We could even have live video. But you were right. The beam spread would include all the ships in the central cluster of fleets. If we could reliably identify an outlying vessel as belonging to Chandra K, then what you were asking might be done. That ship could use internal fleet codes to relay to the others. But in honesty, I must warn you, continued Blue Shell, brushing back Greenstalk's gentle remonstrance. Professional communications folk would not honor your request for talk, would probably not even recognize it as such.
Silly. Greenstalk finally spoke, her voter voice gentle but clear. You always say things like that, except when we are talking to paying customers.
Brap. Yes. Desperate times, desperate measures. I want to try it, but I fear... I want there to be no accusation of rider treachery, Sir Fahm. I want you to handle this.
Fahm knew and smiled back.
My thought exactly.
The Aniara fleet. That's what some of the crews of commercial security were calling themselves. Aniara was the ship of an old human myth, older than Nuyora, perhaps going back to the Tuvo-Norsh cooperatives in the asteroids of Earth's solar system. In the story, Aniara was a large ship launched into interstellar depths just before the death of its parent civilization. The crew watched the death agonies of the home system, and then over the following years, as their ship fell out and out into the endless dark, died themselves, their life support systems slowly failing. The image was a haunting one, which was probably the reason it was known across millennia. With the destruction of Chandra K and the escape of commercial security, the story seemed suddenly come true. But we will not play it to the end. Group Captain Kjet Svensson-Dott stared into the tracking display. This time, the death of civilization had been a murder, and the murderers were almost within vengeance's reach. For days, Fleet HQ had been maneuvering them to close with the Alliance. The display showed that success was very, very near.
The majority of Alliance and Chandra K ships were bound in a glowing ball of drive traces, which also included the 3rd Silent Fleet. From that display, you might think that battle was already possible. In fact, opposing ships were passing through almost the same space, sometimes less than a billion kilometers apart, but still separated by milliseconds of time. All the vessels were on ultra drive, jumping perhaps a dozen times a second. And even here at the bottom of the beyond, that came to a measurable fraction of a light year on each jump. To fight an uncooperative enemy meant matching their jumps perfectly and flooding the common space with weapon drones. Group Captain Svensson Dot changed the display to show ships that had exactly matched their pace with the Alliance. Almost a third of the fleet was in sync now. Another few hours and... Damnation! He slapped his display board, sending it spinning across the deck. His first officer retrieved the display, sent it sailing back.
Is this a new damnation or the usual?
Tirole asked.
It was the usual. Sorry.
And he really was. Tirole and Glimfrella had their own problems. No doubt there were still pockets of humanity in the beyond, hidden from the Alliance. But of the Dirachmes, there might be no more than those on Commercial Security's fleet, except for adventurous souls like Tirole and Glimfrella. All that was left of their kind had been in the dream terrains at Chandra K. Kiet Svensson Dot had been with Commercial Security for 25 years, back when the company had been just a small fleet of rent-a-cops. He had spent thousands of hours learning to be the very best combat pilot in the organization. Only twice had he ever been in a shootout. Some might have regretted that. Svensson Dot and his superiors took it as the reward for being the best. His competence had won him the best fighting equipment in Commercial Security's fleet, culminating with the ship he commanded now. The Elvira was purchased with part of the enormous premium that Chandra K paid out when the Alliance first started making threatening noises. Elvira was not a rebuilt freighter, but a fighting machine from the keel out. The ship was equipped with the smartest processors and the smartest ultra-drive that could operate at Chandra K's altitude and the beyond. It needed only a 3-person crew, and combat could be managed by the pilot alone with his AI associates. Its holds contained more than 10,000 seeker bombs, each smarter than the average freighter's entire drive unit. Quite a reward for 25 years of solid performance. They even let Svensson Dot name his new ship. And now... Well, the true Elvira was surely dead, along with billions of others they had been hired to protect. She had been at Herta, in the inner system. Glow bombs leave no survivors. And his beautiful ship with the same name, it had been a half-light year out system, seeking enemies that weren't there. In any honest battle, Kiet Svensson Dot and this Elvira could have done very well. Instead, they were chasing down into the bottom of the beyond. Every light year took them further from the regions Elvira was built for. Every light year, the processors worked a bit more slowly, or not at all. Down here, the converted freighters were almost an optimum design, clumsy and stupid, with crews of dozens, but they kept on working. Already, Elvira was lagging 5 light-years behind them. It was the freighters that would make the attack on the Alliance fleet, and once again, Kiet would stand powerless while his friends died. For the 100th time, Svensson Dot glared at the trace display and contemplated mutiny. There were Alliance stragglers, too, high-performance vehicles left behind the central pack. But his orders were to maintain position, to be a tactical coordinator for the fleet's swifter combatants. Well, he would do as he was hired, this one last time. But when the battle was done, when the fleet was dead, along with as many of the Alliance as they could take with them, then he would think of his own revenge. Some of that depended on Tirole and Glimfrella. Could he persuade them to leave the remnants of the Alliance fleet and ascend to the middle beyond, up where the Vera was the best of her kind? There was solid evidence about which star systems were behind the Alliance for the Defense. The murderers were boasting to the news. Apparently, they thought that would bring them new support. It might also bring them visitors like Elvira. The bombs in her belly could destroy worlds, though not as swiftly sure as what had been used on Chandra K. And even now, Svensson Dott's mind shrank from that sort of revenge. No. They would choose their targets carefully. Ships coming to form new alliance fleets, under protected convoys. Elvira might last a long time if he always struck from ambush and never left survivors. He stared and stared at the display and ignored the wetness that floated at the corners of his eyes. All his life he had lived by the law. Often his job had been to stop acts of revenge, and now revenge was all that life had left for him.
"I'm getting something peculiar, Cat."
Glimfrella was monitoring signals this watch.
It was the sort of thing that should have been totally automated, and had been in Elvira's natural environment, but which was now a boring and exhausting enterprise.
"What? More net lies?" said Tirola.
"No. This is on the bearing of that bottom lugger everyone is chasing. It can't be anyone else."
Svensson Dott's eyebrows rose. He turned on the mystery with enormous, scarcely realized pleasure.
"Characteristics?"
"Ship signal processor says it's probably a narrow beam. We are its only likely target. The signal is strong and the bandwidth is at least enough to support flat video.
If our snarfling digital signal processor was working right, I'd know."
Frella sang a little song that was impatient humming among his kind.
"Aye. It's encrypted, but at a high layer. This stuff is Syntax 45 video. In fact, it claims to be using one-third of a cipher the company made a year back."
For an instant, Svensson Dott thought Frella was claiming the message itself was smart. That should be absolutely impossible here at the bottom. The second officer must have caught his look.
"Just sloppy language, boss. I read this out of the frame format."
Something flashed on his display.
"Okay, here's the story on the cipher. The company made it and its peers to cover shipping security."
Back before the Alliance, that had been the highest crypto level in the organization.
"This is the third that never got delivered. The whole was assumed compromised, but miracle of miracles, we still have a copy."
Both Frella and Rolla were looking at Svensson Dott expectantly, their eyes large and dark. Standard policy, standard orders, were that transmissions on compromised keys were to be ignored. If the company's signals people had been doing a proper job, the rotted cipher wouldn't even have been aboard, and the policy would have enforced itself.
"Decrypt the thing," Svensson Dott said shortly.
The last weeks had demonstrated that his company was a dismal failure when it came to military intelligence and signals. They might as well get some benefit from that incompetence.
"Yes, sir."
Glemfrella tapped a single key. Somewhere inside Elvira's signal processor, a long segment of random noise was broken into frames and laid precisely down on the random noise and the data frames incoming. There was a perceptible pause. "Damn the bottom." And then the comm window lit with a flat video picture.
"Fourth repetition of this message."
The words were Somnorsh and a dialect of pure Herta Ishandra. The speaker was... For a heart-stopping instant, he was seeing Elvira again, alive. He exhaled slowly, trying to relax. Black-haired, slim, violet-eyed, just like Elvira. And just like a million other women of Chandra K. The resemblance was there, but so vague, he would never have been taken by it before. For an instant, he imagined a universe beyond their lost fleet and goals beyond vengeance. Then he forced his attention back to business, to seeing everything he could in the images in the window. The woman was saying,
"We'll repeat three more times. If by then you have still not responded, we will attempt a different target. She pushed back from the camera pickup, giving them a view of the room behind her. It was low-ceilinged, deep. An ultra-drive trace display dominated the background, but Svensson-Dot paid it little attention. There were two Skrota riders in the background. One wore stripes on its Skrota that meant a trade history with Chandra K. The other must be a lesser rider. Its Skrota was small and wheelless. The pickup turned, centered on the fourth figure. Human? Probably, but of no New Yoran heritage. And another time his appearance would have been big news across all human civilizations in the beyond. Now the point only registered on Svensson-Dot's mind as another cause for suspicion. The woman continued, "You can see that we are human and rider. We are the entire crew of the Out of Band Two. We are not part of the Alliance for the Defense, nor agents of the Blight. But we are the reason their fleets are down here. If you can read this, we're betting that you are of Chandra K. We must talk. Please reply using the tail of the pad that is decrypting this message." The picture jigged and the woman's face was back in the foreground. "This is the fifth repetition of this message," she said. "We'll repeat two more." Glemfrella cut the audio.
"If she means it, we have about 100 seconds. What next, Captain?"
Suddenly, the Elvira was not an irrelevant straggler.
"We talk," said Svensson-Dot.
Response and counter-response took a matter of seconds. After that, 5 minutes of conversation with Ravna Bergsson-Dot was enough to convince Kiet that what she had to say must be heard by Fleet Central. His ship would be a mere relay, but at least he had something very important to pass on. Fleet Central refused the full video link coming from the out-of-band. Someone on the flagship was dead set on following standard procedures and using compromised cipher keys stuck in their craw. Even Kiet had to settle for a combat link. The screen showed a color image with high resolution. Looking at it carefully, one realized the thing was a poor evocation. Kiet recognized Onur Lemende and Jan Schritz, her chief of staff, but they looked several years out of style. Old video matched with the transmitted animation cues. The actual communication channel was less than 4,000 bits per second. Central was taking no chances. God only knew what they were seeing as the evocation of Fom Nguyen. The smoky-skinned human had already explained his point several times. He was having as little success as Ravna Bergsson-Dot before him. His cool manner had gradually deserted him. Desperation was beginning to show on his face.
"And I'm telling you, they are both your enemies. Sure, Alliance for the Defense destroyed Chandra K, but the Blight is responsible for the situation that made that possible."
The half-cartoonish figure of Jan Schritz glanced at Onur Lemende.
"Lord, evocations are crappy at the bottom," Svensson-Dot thought to himself.
When Schritz spoke, his voice didn't even match his lip movements.
"We do read threats, Mr. Nguyen. The threat of the Blight was used as an excuse to destroy our worlds. We will not go on random killing sprees, especially against an organization that is clearly the enemy of our enemy. Or are you claiming the Blight is secretly in league with the Alliance for the Defense?"
Fom gave an angry shrug.
"No, I have no idea how the Blight regards the Alliance, but you should know the evil the Blight has been up to, things on a scale far grander than this Alliance." "Ah, yes, that's what it says on the net, Mr. Nguyen, but those events are thousands of light-years away. They've been through multiple hops and unknown interpretations before they ever arrived in the middle beyond, even if the stories were true to begin with. It is not called the net of a million lies for nothing."
The stranger's face darkened. He said something loud and angry in a language that was totally unlike anything from New Yora. The tones jumped up and down, almost like Dirachemy twittering.
He calmed himself with a visible effort, but when he continued, his somnorsh was even more heavily accented than before.
Yes, but I'm telling you, I was at the fall of Relay. The blight is more than the worst horrors you've heard. The murder of Chandra Kay was its smallest side effect. Will you help us against the blighter fleet?
Owner Lemonda pushed her massive form back into her chair webbing. She looked at her chief of staff, and the two talked inaudibly. Kiet's gaze drifted beyond them. The flagship's command deck extended a dozen meters behind Lemonda. Under officers moved quietly about, some watching the conversation. The picture was crisp and clear, but when the figures moved, it was with cartoon-like awkwardness. And some of the faces belonged to people Kiet knew had been transferred before the fall of Chandra Kay. The processors here on the Vera were taking the narrowband signal from Fleet Central, fleshing it out with detailed and out-of-date background and evoking the image shown. No more evocations after this, Svensson Dutt promised himself, at least while we're down here. Owner Lemonda looked back at the camera.
Forgive a paranoid old cop, but I think it's possible that you might be of the blight.
Lemonda raised her hand as if to ward off interruptions, but the redhead just gaped in surprise.
If we believe you, then we must accept that there is something useful and dangerous on the star system we're all heading towards. Furthermore, we must accept that both you and the blighter fleet are peculiarly qualified to take advantage of this prize. If we fight them, as you ask, there will likely be few of us alive afterwards. You alone will have the prize. We fear what you might turn out to be.
For a long moment, Fom Nguyen was silent. The wildness slowly left his face.
You have a point, Owner Lemonda, and a dilemma. Is there any way out?
Schritz and I have been discussing it. No matter what we do, both we and you must take big chances. It's only the alternatives that are more terrible. We are willing to accept your guidance in battle if you will first maneuver your ship back toward us and allow us to board.
Give up the lead in this chase, you mean?
Lemonda nodded. Fom's mouth opened and closed, but no words emerged. He seemed to be having trouble breathing. Ravna said,
Then if you don't succeed, everything is lost. At least now we have a 60-hour lead. That might be enough to get word out about this artifact, even if the blighter fleet survives.
Schritt's face twisted a cartoonish smile.
You can't have it both ways. You want us to risk everything on your assurances. We are willing to die for this, but not to be pawns in a game of monsters.
The last words had a strange tone, the angry delivery shading away. And now there was no motion in the picture from Fleet Central except for ill-synced lip movement. Glimfrella caught Svensson Dott's eye and pointed at the failure lights on his comm panel. Schritt's voice continued.
And Group Captain Svensson Dott, it's imperative that all further communications with this unknown vessel be channeled.
The image froze, and there were no more words.
Ravna, what happened?
Glimfrella made a twitter snort.
We're losing the link with Fleet Central. Our effective bandwidth is down to 20 bits per second and dropping. Schritt's last transmission was scarcely 100 bits.
Padded out to apparent legibility by the Elvira software. Kiet waved angrily at the screen.
Cut the damn thing off.
At least he wouldn't have to put up with the evocation any further. And he didn't want to hear what he guessed was Jan Schritt's last order. Tirola said,
Hi, why not leave it on? We might not notice much difference.
Glimfrellas snickered at his brother's wit, but his long fingers danced across the comm panel, and the display became a window on the stars. The two Dirachmes had a thing about bureaucrats. Svensson Dott ignored them and looked at the remaining comm window. The channel to Fom and Ravna was wideband video with scarcely any interpretation. There would be no perverse subtleties if it went down.
Sorry about that. The last few days we've had a lot of problems with Calm. Apparently this zone storm is the worst in centuries. In fact, it was getting still worse. Half the Ultra Trace displays were showing random garbage.
You've lost contact with your command? Asked Ravna.
For the moment.
He glanced at Fahm. The redhead's eyes were still a bit glassy.
Look, I'm even more sorry about how things have turned out, but Limonda and Schritz are bright people. You can see their point of view. Strange, interrupted Fahm. The pictures were strange.
His tone was drifty.
You mean our relay from Fleet Central?
Svensson-Dodd explained about the narrow bandwidth and the crummy performance of his ship's processors down here at the bottom.
And so their picture of us must have been equally bad. I wonder what they thought I was.
Good question. Consider Fahm Nguyen. Bristly red hair, smoke-gray skin, sing-song voice. If cues such as those were sent, like as not, the display at Fleet Central would show something quite different from the human Kiet saw.
Wait a minute. That's not how evocations work. I'm sure they got a pretty clear view of you. See, a few high-resolution pics would get sent at the beginning of the session. Then those would be used as the base for the animation.
Fahm stared back lumpishly, almost as though he didn't buy it and was daring Kiet to think things through. Well, damn it, the explanation was correct. There was no doubt that Limonda and Schritz had seen the redhead as a human. Yet there was something here that bothered Kiet. Limonda and Schritz had both looked out of date.
Glimfelle, check the raw stream we got from Central. Did they send us any sync pictures?
It took Glimfella only seconds. He whistled a sharp tone of surprise.
No, boss. And since it was all properly encrypted, our end just made do with old ad animation.
He said something to Tirola, and the two twittered rapidly.
Nothing seems to work down here. Maybe this is just another bug.
But Glimfella didn't sound very confident of his assertion. Svensson-Dodd turned back to the picture from the out-of-band.
Look, the channel to Fleet Central was fully encrypted. Using one-time schemes, I trust more than what we're talking with now. I can't believe it was a masquerade.
But nausea was creeping up Kiet's guts. This was like the first minutes of the battle for Chandrakay, when he guessed how thoroughly they had been outmaneuvered, when he realized that everyone he was trying to protect would be murdered.
Hi, we'll contact other vessels. We'll verify Central's location.
Fahm Nguyen raised an eyebrow.
Maybe it wasn't a masquerade.
Before he could say more, one of the riders, the one with the greater scrota, was shouting at them. It rolled across the room's apparent ceiling, pushing the humans aside to get close to the camera.
I have a question.
The voter speech was burred, nearly unintelligible. The creature's tendrils rattled dryly against each other, as distressed as Kiet Svensson-Dodd had ever heard.
My question, are there scrota riders aboard your fleet's command vessel? Why do you... Answer the question. How should I know?
Kiet tried to think.
Tirola, you have friends on Schritt's staff. Are there any riders aboard?
Tirola stuttered a few bars.
Yes. Emergency hires rescues, actually, right after the battle. That's the best we can do, friend.
The scrota rider trembled, unspeaking. Then its tendrils seemed to wilt.
Thank you,
it said softly. It rolled back and out of camera range. Fahm Nguyen disappeared from view. Ravna looked wildly around.
Wait, please, she said to the camera,
and Kiet was looking at the abandoned command deck of the out-of-band. At the limit of the pickup's hearing came sounds of mumbled conversation, voter and human. Then she was back.
What was that all about? Svensson-Dodd to Ravna.
Nothing any of us can help anymore.
Captain Svensendott, it looks to me like your fleet is no longer run by the people you think.
Maybe. Probably. It's something I've got to think about.
She nodded. For a moment, they looked at each other unspeaking. So strange, so far from home, and after all the heartbreak, to see someone so familiar.
You were truly at Relay?
The question sounded stupid in his ears. Yet, in a way, she was a bridge from what he knew and trusted to the deadly weirdness of the present situation. Ravna Bergshendott nodded.
Yes. And it was like everything you've read. We even had direct contact with the power. And yet it was not enough, Group Captain. The Blight destroyed it all. That part of the news is no lie.
Tarola pushed back from his nav station.
Then how can anything you do down here hurt the Blight?
The words were blunt, but Rolla's eyes were wide and serious. In fact, he was pleading for some sense behind all the death.
Dirachmes had not been the greatest part of the Chandra K civilization, but they had been by far its oldest member race. A million years ago, they had burst out of the slow zone, colonizing the three systems that humans one day would call Chandra K. Long before the humans arrived, they were a race of inward dreamers. They protected their star systems with ancient automation and friendly younger races. Another 500,000 years and their race might be gone from the beyond, extinct or evolved into something else. It was a common pattern, something like death and old age, but gentler. There is a common misconception about such senescent races, that their members are senescent too. In any large population, there will be variation. There will always be those who want to see the outside world and play there for a while. Humankind had gotten on very well with the likes of Glimfrella and Tirola. And Bergshendott seemed to understand.
Have any of you heard of Godshatter?
Kiet said, no, then noticed that both Dirachmes had started. They whistled at each other for several seconds.
Yes,
Rolla spoke at last in Somnorsh, his voice as close to awe as Kiet had ever heard.
You know we Dirachmes have been in the beyond for a long time. We've sent many colonies into the Transcend. Some became powers. And once, something came back. It wasn't a power, of course. In fact, it was more like a mind-crippled Dirachmes. But it knew things and did things that made great changes for us.
Fentrolar?
Kiet asked wonderingly, suddenly recognizing the story. It had happened 100,000 years before humankind arrived at Chandra K, yet it was a central contradiction of the Dirachmes terrains.
Yes, Tarola said. Even now people don't agree if Fentrolar was a gift or a curse. But he founded the dream habitats and the old religion.
Ravna nodded. That's the case most familiar to us of Chandra K. Maybe it's not a happy example, considering all its effects. And she told them about the fall of Relay, what had happened to Old One, and what had become of Famnuin. The Dirachmes' side chat dwindled to zero, and they were very still. Finally, Kiet said,
so what does new... He stumbled over the name, as strange as everything else about this fellow. No one know about the thing he seeks at the bottom. What can he do with it?
I don't know, Group Captain. Famnuin himself doesn't know. A little bit at a time, the insight comes, I believe, because I was there for some of it. But I don't know how to make you believe.
She drew a shuddering breath. Kiet suddenly guessed what a tortured place the out-of-band must be. Somehow, that made the story more credible. Anything that really could destroy the Blight would be unwholesomely weird. Kiet wondered how he would do, locked up with such a thing.
My Lady Ravna, he said, the words stilted and formal.
After all, I'm suggesting treason.
I've got a number of friends in the commercial security fleet. I can check on the suspicions you've raised and...
say it. It's possible we can give you support in spite of my HQ.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Glimfrele broke the silence.
We're getting a poor signal on the out-of-bands channel now.
Kietai swept the windows. All the ultra-trace displays looked like random noise. Whatever the storm was, it was bad.
Looks like we won't be talking much longer, Ravna Bergschendott.
Yes, we're losing signal. Group Captain, if none of this works, if you can't fight for us, your people are all that's left of Chandra K. It's been good to see you and the Dirachamis. After so long to see familiar faces, people I really understand, I...
As she spoke, her image square blurred into low-frequency components.
Hui, said Glimfrele. Bandwidth just dropped through the floor.
There was nothing sophisticated about their link to the out-of-band. Given communications problems, the ship's processors just switched to low-rate coding.
Hello, out of band. We've got problems on this channel now. Suggest we sign off.
The window turned gray, and printed Somnorsh flickered across it.
Yes, it is more than a communication.
Glimfrele diddled his comm panel.
Zip, zero, he said. No detectable signal.
Tarola looked up from his navigation tank.
This is a lot more than a communications problem. Our computers haven't been able to commit on an ultra-drive jump in more than 20 seconds.
They had been doing 5 jumps a second and just over a light-year per hour. Now, Glimfrele leaned back from his panel.
Hi. So welcome to the slow zone.
The slow zone. Ravna Bergschendott looked across the deck of the out-of-band too. Somewhere in the back of her mind, she had always had a vision of the slowness as a stifling darkness lit at best by torches, the domain of cretins and mechanical calculators. In fact, things didn't look much different from before. The ceilings and walls glowed just as before. The stars still shone through the windows. Only now it might be a very long time before any of them moved. It was on the OOB's other displays that the change was most obvious. The ultra-trace tank blinked monotonously, a red legend displaying elapsed time since the last update. Navigation windows were filled with output from the diagnostics exercising the drive processors. An audible message in Trisk Wayline was repeating over and over, "Warning, transition to slowness detected, execute back jump at once." Warning, transition to slowness detected, execute.
Turn that off.
Ravna grabbed a saddle and strapped herself down. She was actually feeling dizzy, though that could only be a very natural panic.
Some bottom lugger this is. We run right into the slow zone, and all it can do is spout warnings after the fact.
Greenstalk drifted closer, tiptoeing off the ceiling with her tendrils.
Even bottom luggers can't avoid things like this, my Lady Ravna.
Fom said something at the ship, and most of the displays cleared. Blue Shell.
Even a huge zone storm doesn't normally extend more than a few light years. We were 200 light years above the zone boundary. What hit us must be a monster surge, the sort of thing you only read about in archives.
Small consolation.
We knew something like this could happen. Fom said. Things have been getting awfully rough the last few weeks.
For a change, he didn't seem too upset.
Yes, she said. We expected a slowing, maybe, but not the slowness.
We are trapped.
Where's the nearest habitable system? 10 light years? 50?
The vision of darkness had a new reality, and the starscape beyond the ship's walls was no longer a friendly, steadying thing. They were surrounded by unending nothingness, moving at some vanishing fraction of the speed of light, entombed. All the courage of Kiet Svensendott and his fleet for nothing. Jeffrey Olshendott forever unrescued. Fom's hand touched her shoulder, the first touch in days.
We can still make it to the Tynes world. This is a bottom lugger, remember. We are not trapped. Hell, the ram scoop on this buggy is better than anything I ever had in the Cheng Ho, and I thought I was the freest man in the universe back then.
Decades of travel time, mostly in cold sleep. Such had been the world of the Cheng Ho. The world of Fom's memories. Ravna let out a shuddering breath that ended in weak laughter. For Fom, the terrible pressure was abated, at least temporarily. He could be human.
"What's so funny?" said Fom.
She shook her head. "All of us. Never mind." She took a couple of slow breaths. "Okay, I think I can make rational conversation. So the zone has surged, something that normally takes 1,000 years, even in a storm, to move a single light-year has suddenly shifted 200. Huh. There'll be people 1,000,000 years from now reading about this in the archives. I'm not sure I want the honor. We knew there was a storm, but I never expected to be drowned.
Buried beneath the sea, light-years deep."
"The sea-storm analogy is not perfect," said Blueshell.
The scroter rider was still on the far side of the deck, where he had retreated after questioning the Chandra K captain. He still looked upset, though he was back to sounding precise and picky. Blueshell was studying a nav display, evidently a recording from right before the surge. He dumped the picture to a display flat and rolled slowly across the ceiling toward them. Greenstalk's fronds brushed him gently as he passed. He sealed the display flat into Ravna's hands and continued in a lecturing tone.
"Even in a sea storm, the water's surface is never as roiled as in a big interface disturbance. The most recent news reports showed it as a fractal surface with dimension close to 3, like foam and spray."
Even he could not avoid the storm analogy. The starscapes hung serene beyond crystal walls, and the loudest sound was from the ship's ventilators. Yet they had been swallowed in a maelstrom. Blueshell waved a frond at the display flat.
"We could be back in the beyond in a few hours."
"What?"
"See, the plane of the display is determined by the positions of the supposed Chandra K command vessel, the outflying craft that we contacted directly, and ourselves."
The three formed a narrow triangle, the Limenda and Svensson-Dot vertices close together.
"I've marked the times that contact was lost with the others. Notice, the link to Commercial Security HQ went down 150 seconds before we were hit. From the incoming signal and its requests for protocol changes, I believe that both we and the outflyer were enveloped at about the same time."
Fom nodded.
"Yeah. The most distant sites losing contact last. That must mean the surge moved in from the side."
"Exactly."
From his perch on the ceiling, Blueshell reached to tap the display.
"The three ships were like probes in the standard zone mapping technique. Replaying the trace displays will no doubt confirm the conclusion."
Ravna looked at the plot. The long point of the triangle, tipped by the OOB, pointed almost directly toward the heart of the galaxy.
"It must have been a huge cliff-like thing, perpendicular to the rest of the surface."
"A monster wave sweeping sideways," said Greenstalk. "And that's also why it won't last long."
"Yes. It's the radio changes that are most often long-term. This thing must have a trailing edge. We should pass through it in a few hours, and back into the beyond."
So there was still a race to be won, or lost. The first hours were strange. A few hours had been Blueshell's estimate of when they would be back in the beyond. They hung around the bridge, alternately watching the clock and stewing about the strange conversations just completed. Fun was building himself back to trigger tension.
Any time now they would be back in the beyond. What to do then?
If only a few ships were perverted, perhaps Svensson-Dot could still coordinate an attack. Would that do any good? Fon played the ultra-trace recordings over and over, studying every detectable ship in all the fleets.
"But when we get out,
I'll know what to do. Not why I must do it, but what.
And he couldn't explain more. Any time now. There was scarcely any reason to do much about resetting equipment that would need another initialization right away. But after 8 hours, it really could be longer, even a day. They had been scrounging around in some of the historical literature. Maybe we should do a little housekeeping. The out-of-band, too, had been designed for both the beyond and the slowness, but that second environment was regarded as an unlikely emergency one. There were special-purpose processors for the slow zone, but they hadn't come up automatically. With Blueshell's advice, FOM took the high-performance automation offline. That wasn't too difficult, except for a couple of voice-actuated independents that were no longer bright enough to understand the quitting commands. Using the new automation gave Ravna a chill that in a subtle way was almost as frightening as the original loss of the Ultra Drive. Her image of the slowness as darkness and torchlight, that was just nightmare fantasy. On the other hand, the slowness as the domain of cretins and mechanical calculators, there was something to that. The OOB's performance had degraded steadily during their voyage to the bottom, but now, gone were the voice-driven graphics generators. They were just a bit too complex to be supported by the new OOB, at least in full interpretive mode. Gone were the intelligent context analyzers that made the ship's library almost as accessible as one's own memories. Eventually, Ravna even turned off the art and music units. Without mood and context response, they seemed so wooden, constant reminders that there were no brains behind them. Even the simplest things were corrupted. Take voice and gesture controls. They no longer responded consistently to sarcasm and casual slang. It took a certain discipline to use them effectively. FOM actually seemed to like this. It reminded him of the Cheng Ho. 20 hours. 50. Everyone was still telling each other there was nothing to worry about. But now Blueshell said that talk of hours had been unrealistic. Considering the height of the tsunami, at least 200 light-years, it would likely be several hundred light-years across. That in keeping with the scaling laws of historical precedent. There was only one trouble with this reasoning. They were beyond all precedent. For the most part, zone boundaries followed galactic mean density. There was virtually no change from year to year, just the eons-long shrinkage that might someday, after the death of all but the smallest stars, expose the galactic core to the beyond. At any given time, perhaps 1/1,000,000,000th of that boundary might qualify as being in a storm state. In an ordinary storm, the surface might move in or out a light year in a decade or so. Such storms were common enough to affect the fortunes of many worlds every year. Much rarer, perhaps once in 100,000 years in the whole galaxy, there would be a storm where the boundary became seriously distorted, and where surges might move at a high multiple of light speed. These were the transverse surges that FOM and Blueshell made their scale estimates from. The fastest moved at about a light year per second across a distance of less than 3 lights. The largest were 30 light years high and moved at scarcely a light year per day. So what was known of monsters like the thing that had engulfed them? Not much. Third-hand stories in the ship's library told of surges perhaps as big as theirs, but the quoted dimensions and propagation rates were not clear. Stories more than 100 million years old are hard to trust. There are scarcely any intermediate languages. And even if there were, it wouldn't have helped. The new dumb version of the OOB absolutely could not do mechanical translation of natural languages. Dredging the library was pointless. When Ravna complained about this to FOM, he said, "Things could be worse. What was the partition, really?" 5 billion years ago. No one's sure. FOM jerked a thumb at his library display.
Some people think it was a super surge, you know. Something so big it swallowed the races that might have recorded it. Sometimes the biggest disasters aren't noticed at all. No one's around to write horror stories.
Great.
I'm sorry, Ravna. Honestly, if we're in anything like most past disasters, we'll come out of it in another day or two. The best thing is to plan for things that way. This is like a time out in the battle. Take advantage of it to have a little peace. Figure out how to get the unperverted parts of commercial security to help us.
Yeah.
Depending on the shape of the surge's trailing edge, the OOB might have lost a good part of its lead. But I'll bet the Alliance fleet is completely panicked by all this. Such opportunists would likely run for safety as soon as they're back in the beyond. The advice kept her busy for another 20 hours, fighting with the half-witted things that claimed to be strategy planners on the new version of the OOB. Even if the surge passed right this instant, it might be too late. There were players in this game for whom the surge was not a timeout. Jeffrey Olschendott and his Tynish allies. It had been 70 hours now since their last contact. Ravna had missed 3 comm sessions with them. If she were panicked, what must it be like for Jeffrey? Even if Steele could hold off his enemies, time and trust would be running out at Tyne's World. 100 hours into the surge, Ravna noticed that Blueshell and Fom were doing power tests on the OOB's ram scoop drive. Some timeouts last forever. Chapter 34. The summer hot spell broke for a time. In fact, it was almost chilly. There was still the smoke, and the air was still dry, but the wind seemed less driven. Inside their cubby aboard the ship, Amdi Yefri weren't taking much notice of the nice weather.
"They've been slow in answering before," said Amdi. "She's explained how the ultra-wave..." "Ravna's never been this late."
"Not since the winter, anyway."
Jeffrey's tone hovered between fear and petulance. In fact, there was supposed to be a transmission in the middle of the night, technical data for them to pass on to Mr. Steele. It hadn't arrived by this morning, and now Ravna had also missed their afternoon session, the time when normally they could just chat for a bit. The two children reviewed all the comm settings. The previous fall, they had laboriously copied those and the first-level diagnostics. It all looked the same now, except for something called carrier detect. If they only had a data set, they might have looked up what that meant. They had even very carefully reset some of the comm parameters, then nervously set them back when nothing happened. Maybe they hadn't given the changes enough of a chance to work. Maybe now they had really messed something up.
They stayed in the command cubby all through the afternoon, their minds cycling through fear and boredom and frustration. After 4 hours, boredom had at least a temporary victory. Jeffrey was napping uneasily in his father's hammock with 2 of Amdi curled up in his arms. Amdi poked idly around the room, looked at the rocket controls. No, not even his self-confidence was up to playing with those. Another of him jerked at the wall quilting. He could always watch the fungus grow for a while. Things were that slow. Actually, the gray stuff had spread a lot farther than the last time he looked. Behind the quilt, it was quite thick. He sent a chain of himself squirreling back between the wall and the fabric. It was dark, but some light spilled through the gap at the ceiling. In most places, the mold was scarcely an inch thick, but back here it was 5 or 6. Wow! Just above his exploring nose, a huge lump of it grew from the wall. This was as big as some of the ornamental moss lumps that decorated castle meeting halls. Slender gray filaments grew down from the fungus. He almost called out to Jeffrey, but the two of him in the hammock were so comfortable. He brought a couple of heads close to the strangeness. The wall behind it looked a little odd, too, as though part of its substance had been taken by the mold, and the gray itself, like smoke. He felt the filaments with his nose. They were solid, dry.
His nose tickled. Omdi froze in shocked surprise. Watching himself from behind, he saw that two of the filaments had actually passed through his member's head, and yet there was no pain, just that tickling feeling.
What?
Yefri had been jostled into wakefulness as Omdi tensed around him.
I found something really strange behind the quilts. I touched this big hunk of fungus and...
As he spoke, Omdi gently backed away from the thing on the wall. The touch didn't hurt, but it made him more nervous than curious. He felt the filament sliding slowly out.
I told you we aren't supposed to play with that stuff. It's dirty. The only good thing is it doesn't smell.
Yefri was out of the hammock. He stepped across the cubby and lifted the quilting. Andy's tip member lost its balance and jerked away from the fungus. There was a snapping sound and a sharp pain in his lip.
Geez, that thing is big!
Then, hearing Omdi's pain whistle, "You okay?" Omdi backed away from the wall.
"I think so."
The tip of one last filament was still stuck in his lip. It didn't hurt as much as the nettles he'd sampled a few days earlier. Omdi Yefri looked over the wound. What was left of the smoky spine seemed hard and brittle. Yefri's fingers gently worked it free. Then the two of them turned to wonder at the thing in the wall.
It really has spread. Looks like it's hurt the wall, too.
Omdi dabbed at his bloodied muzzle.
Yeah, I see why your folks told you to stay away from it. Maybe we should have Mr. Steele scrub it all out.
The two spent half an hour crawling around behind all the quilting. The grayness had spread far, but there was only the one marvelous flowering. They came back to stare at it, even sticking articles of clothing into the wisps. Neither risked fingers or noses on further contact. Staring at the fungus on the wall was by far the most exciting thing that happened that afternoon. There was no message from the OOB. The next day, the hot weather was back. Two more days passed, and still, there was no word from Ravna. Lord Steele paced the walls atop on Starship Hill. It was near the middle of the night, and the sun hung about 15 degrees above the northern horizon. Sweat filmed his fur. This was the warmest summer in 10 years. The dry wind was into its 30th day around. It was no longer a welcome break in the chill of the Northland. The crops were dying in the fields. Smoke from fjord fires was visible as brownish haze both north and south of the castle. At first, the reddish color had been a novelty, a change from the unending blue of sky and distance and the whitish haze of the sea fogs. Only at first. When fire struck East Streamsdell, the entire sky had been dipped in red. Ash had rained all the day around, and the only smell had been that of burning. Some said it was worse than the filthy air of the southern cities. The troops on the walls backed far out of his way. This was more than courtesy, more than their fear of steel. His troops were still not used to the cloaked ones, and the cover story Shrek was spreading did nothing to ease their minds. Lord Steele was accompanied by a singleton, in the colors of a lord. The creature made no mind sounds. It walked incredibly close to its master. Steele said to the singleton,
"Success is a matter of meeting a schedule. I remember you teaching me that."
Cutting it into me, in fact. The member looked back at him, cocked its head.
"As I remember, I said that success was a matter of adapting to changes in schedules."
The words were perfectly articulated. There were singletons that could talk that well, but even the most verbal could not carry on intelligent conversation. Shrek had had no trouble convincing the troops that Flenser science had created a race of super packs, that the cloaked ones were individually as smart as any ordinary pack. It was a good cover for what the cloaks really were. It both inspired fear and obscured the truth. The member stepped a little closer, nearer to Steele than anyone had been except during murders and rapes and the beatings of the past. Involuntarily, Steele licked his lips and spread out from around the threat. Yet in some ways, the dark cloaked one was like a corpse without a trace of mind sound. Steele snapped his jaws shut and said,
"Yes,
The genius is in winning even when the schedules have fallen down the guard robe.
He looked all away from the Flenser member, scanning the red-shrouded southern horizon.
What's the latest estimate of Woodcarver's progress?
She's still camped about 5 days southeast of here.
The damned incompetent. It's hard to believe she's your parent.
Vindacious made things so easy for her. Her soldiers and toy cannon should have been here almost a 10-day past.
And been well butchered on schedule.
Yes, long before our sky friends arrived. Instead, she wanders inland and then balks.
The Flenser member shrugged in its dark cloak. Steele knew the radio was as heavy as it looked. It consoled him that the other was paying a price for his omniscience. Just think, in heat like this, to have every part of oneself muffled to the tympana. He could imagine the discomfort. Indoors, he could smell it. They walked past one of the wall cannon. The barrel gleamed of layered metal. The thing had thrice the range of Woodcarver's pitiful invention. While Woodcarver had been working with dataset and a human child's intuition, he had had the direct advice of Ravna and company. At first, he'd feared their largesse, thinking it meant the visitors were superior beyond need for care. Now, the more he heard of Ravna and the others, the more clearly he understood their weakness. They could not experiment with themselves, improve themselves. Inflexible, slow-changing dullards. Sometimes they showed a low cunning, Ravna's coyness about what she wanted from the first starship. But their desperation was loud in all their messages, as was their attachment to the human child. Everything had been going so well till just a few days ago. As they walked out of earshot of the gunner pack, Steele said to the Flenser member,
"And still no word from our rescuers?"
"Quite so." That was the other botched schedule, the important one, which they could not control. "Ravna has missed 4 sessions. 2 of me is down with Omdiefri right now." The singleton jabbed its snout toward the dome of the inner keep. The gesture was an awkward abortion. Without other muzzles and other eyes, body language was a limited thing. "We just aren't built to wander around a piece here, a piece there." "Another few minutes, and the space folk will have missed a 5th talk session. The children are getting desperate, you know." The member's voice sounded sympathetic. Almost unconsciously, Lord Steele sidled a little farther out from around it. Steele remembered that tone from his own early existence. He also remembered the cutting and death that had always followed.
"I want them kept happy, Tyrefect. We're assuming communication will resume. When it does, we'll need them."
Steele bared 6 pairs of jaws at the surrounded singleton.
"None of your old tricks."
The member flinched, an almost imperceptible twitch that pleased Steele more than the groveling of 10,000. "Of course not. I'm just saying that you should visit them, try to help them with their fear."
"You do it."
"Ah, they don't fully trust me. I've told you before, Steele, they love you."
"Ah, and they've seen through to your meanness, eh?"
The situation made Steele proud. He had succeeded where Flenser's own methods would have failed. He had manipulated without threats or pain. It had been Steele's craziest experiment, and certainly his most profitable.
"But, look, I don't have time to wet-nurse anyone. It's a tiresome thing to talk to those two."
And it was very tiresome to hold his temper, to suffer Yefri's petting and Omdi's pranks. In the beginning, Steele had insisted that no one else have close contact with the children. They were too important to expose to others. The most casual slip-up might show them the truth and ruin them. Even now, Tyrefect was the only pack besides himself who had regular contact. But for Steele, every meeting was worse than the last, an ultimate test of his self-control. It was hard to think straight in a killing rage, and that's how almost every conversation with them ended for Steele. How wonderful it would be when the space folk landed. Then he could use the other end of the tool that was Omdiefri,
Then there would be no need to have their trust and friendship. Then he would have a lever, something to torture and kill to enforce his demands. Of course, if the aliens never landed, or if...
We must do something. I will not be flotsam on a wave of the future.
Steele lashed at the scaffolding that ran along the inner side of the parapet, shredding the wood with his gleaming tines.
We can't do anything about the aliens, so let's deal with Woodcarver. Yes.
He smiled at the Flenser member.
Ironic, isn't it? For 100 years you sought her destruction. Now I can succeed. What would have been your great triumph is for me just an annoying detour, undertaken because greater projects are temporarily delayed.
The cloaked one did not look impressed. There is a little matter of gifts falling out of the sky.
Yes, into my open jaws. And that is my good fortune, isn't it?
He walked on several paces, chuckling to himself.
Yes, it's time to have Vendacious bring his trusting queen in for the slaughter. Maybe it will interfere with other events, but... I know. We'll have the battle east of here.
The Margrim climb?
Correct. Woodcarver's forces should be well concentrated coming up the defile. We'll move our cannon over there, set them behind the ridge line at the top of the climb. It will be easy to destroy all her people, and it's far enough from Starship Hill. Even if the space folk arrive at the same time, we can keep the two projects separate.
The singleton didn't say anything, and after a moment Steele glared at him.
Yes, dear teacher, I know there is a risk. I know it splits our forces, but we've got an army sitting on our doorstep. They've arrived inconveniently late, but even Vendacious can't make them turn around and go home. And if he tries to stall things, the Queen might... Can you predict just what she would do?
No. She has always had a way with the unexpected.
She might even see through Vendacious fraud. So, we take a small chance and destroy her now. You are with Farscout Rongolith?
Yes, two of me.
Tell him to get word to Vendacious. He is to have the Queen's army coming up Margrim Climb not less than 2 days from now. Feel free to elaborate. You know the region better than I. We'll work out final details when both sides are in position.
It was a wonderful thing to be the effective commander of both sides in a battle.
One more thing. It's important, and Vendacious must see to it, within the day around. I want Woodcarver's human dead.
What harm can she do?
That's a stupid question.
Especially coming from you.
We don't know when Ravna and Farm may reach us. Till we have them safe in our jaws, the Johanna creature is a dangerous thing to have nearby. Tell Vendacious to make it look like an accident, but I want that 2 legs dead.
Flenser was everywhere. It was a form of godhood he'd dreamed of since he'd been Woodcarver's newbie. While one of them talked to Steele, 2 others lounged about the starship with Omdi Efri, and 2 more padded through Light Forest just north of Woodcarver's encampment. Paradise can also be an agony, and each day the torment was a little harder to bear. In the first place, this summer was as insufferably hot as any in the north. And the radio cloaks were not merely hot and heavy. They necessarily covered his members' tympana. And unlike other uncomfortable costumes, the price of taking these off, for even a moment, was mindlessness. His first trials had lasted just 1 hour or 2. Then had come a 5-day expedition with Farscout Rongolith, providing Steele with instant information and instant command of the country around Starship Hill. It had taken a couple day-arounds to recover from the sores and aches of the radio cloaks. This latest exercise in omniscience had lasted 12 days. Wearing the cloaks all the time was impossible. Every day in a rotation, one of his members threw off its radio, was bathed, and had its cloak's liner changed.
It was Flenser's hour of daily madness when sometimes the weak-willed Tyrethect would come back to mind, vainly trying to re-establish her dominance. It didn't matter. With one of his members disconnected, the remaining pack was only four. There are foursomes of normal intelligence, but none existed in Flenser Tyrethect. The bathing and re-cloaking were all done in a confused haze. And, of course, even though Flenser was everywhere at once, he wasn't any smarter than before. After the first jarring experiments, he got the hang of seeing, hearing scenes that were radically different. But it was as difficult as ever to carry on multiple conversations. When he was bantering with Steele, his other members had very little to say to Omdi Efri or to Rongolith's scouts. Lord Steele was done with him. Flenser walked along the parapets with his former student, but if Steele had said anything to him, it would have taken him away from his current conversation. Flenser smiled, carefully, so the one with Steele would not show it. Steele thought he was talking to Far Scout Rongolith just now. Oh, he would do that in a few minutes. One advantage of his situation was that no one could know for sure everything Flenser was up to. If he was careful, he would eventually rule here again. It was a dangerous game, and the cloaks were themselves dangerous devices. Keep a cloak out of the sunlight for a few hours, and it lost power, and the member wearing it was cut off from the pack. Worse was the problem of static. That was the mantis word. The second set of cloaks had killed its user, and the spacers weren't sure of the cause, except that it was some sort of interference problem. Flenser had experienced nothing so extreme, but sometimes, on his farthest hikes with Rongolith, or when a cloak's power faded, there was an incredible shrieking in his mind, like a dozen packs crowding close, sounds that scaled between sex madness and killing frenzy. Tyrethect seemed to like times like that. She'd come bounding out of the confusion, swamping him with her soft hate. Normally, she lurked around the edges of his consciousness, tweaking a word here, a motive there. End of Side 12. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.